Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Sarah.
I'm Liz.
And this is the It's Fine, I'm Fine podcast. Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, everyone. We had a bit of a longer hiatus than we usually do between our episodes, but that's because we released two episodes in a row, and Sarah and I, per usual, are busy bees, so thank you for your patience, and we think it's worth the wait because we had an amazing guest on.
Amazing.
Amazing. We are super, super excited to talk to him, but before we intro him, we want to remind everyone about BetterHelp, who sponsors this podcast. BetterHelp is an online counseling service. Basically, you go online, you take an assessment, and they'll match you with a counselor. If that counselor isn't working for you, you have the opportunity to meet with someone else, which is something Sarah and I have both struggled with in trying to find a therapist. So we think it's great that there's an online system that allows you to sort of say, this isn't vibing with me, and that there's other people at your disposal who are willing to work with you and who will help you. Besides the counseling appointments, they also have a messaging service, so you don't just have to video or wait for the next video appointment to talk to your counselor, but you can message them through the secure app anytime. So per usual, if you want to use our code to get 10% off your first month of service, you go to betterhelp.com/itsfine. That's betterhelp.com/itsfine for 10% off your first month of service.
Love it. Liz and I typically record these intros and outros, like a little sneak peek into what we do, but like kind of after the record. So I just find it so fun because we're always buzzing after these amazing guests that we have. It's just, you know, right now I think we're both kind of on a little bit of a high just because we had such an unbelievable and rich conversation with John, who is our guest today. So I don't know. I just wanted to like share that.
Logistical tidbit.
Yeah. All right. Peek and pit.
Definitely. I can go first.
Okay.
My pit is, I just have been really busy and it's hard to grind sometimes, like especially when it feels like the world is opening back up, which don't get me wrong, is so exciting. And I'm really so excited for hope. And I know that, please don't misunderstand, I know that there's still a lot happening in the world, but from our very little bubble, which we live in sometimes, there's a lot of hope in Manhattan and restaurants opening, spending, like we've gone out to restaurants and we've been so lucky to do that. With that being said, it's difficult when you're really busy with work and like, you know, you can't really go outside when it gets nice and people are out all the time. So that's been challenging. My peak though was as you all know, Sarah and I do Shabbat together almost every week. And Alana, our best friend and momager, has been here for the past couple of weeks before she officially moves home to Florida, which is another pit, but that's a separate thing. Peak for now is that we had such a fun Shabbat on Friday. Like they're always fun, but it was just like, It was just like such a vibe, and it was the last one of like the three of us plus Chris before Alana goes home, and we just were like listening to the Jonas Brothers and Taylor Swift. Like it was so beautiful. We were like screaming at the top of our lungs all the songs.
It was so
and Sarah
fun.
Like Sarah literally paused the music and she was like, "Everyone wants to be us," and it was so funny and true. Like, okay, not everyone wants to be us, but like we had a moment where we were like, we're like what we dreamed about as kids, like what our friends would be like when we were older.
Yeah.
And like, cause you know, I think most people, girls, whoever, however you identify, like you have those moments in your room where you just listen to music and you're like, this is like the peak of life. Like this is so fun. And being able to do that with other people is just a peak always.
Yeah. Like we don't actually think people want to be us, especially with all the anxiety that we have.
No, totally. Like the
but
trauma.
It was more so just recognizing like, wow, these friendships and the fact that we get to just sit here and like be our truest selves, yelling out fearless, dancing, and like not only caring about what each other thinks, but like all doing it together. It's
totally
just, it was Friday was so fun.
So fun.
Like the sushi was great, the challah was great. The time that we spent outside my apartment sitting in these like chairs and these high schoolers were like, pss, 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 I wonder how old they are. Like, should we go ask them to buy us alcohol? We felt just like so cool. Yeah, no, that I have all the same peaks as well. and the pit. I've been working a lot too, but were you done?
I'm done.
Okay. My pit is that I randomly got really sick on Sunday night and like felt so nauseous. And you know what? Looking back and after having a couple conversations with a couple different friends, I've come to the conclusion that I ate old kale and cucumber. And I just, folks, don't. If you even doubt that your kale and your cucumber are a little old, just throw them away.
Yeah.
Because I was extremely unwell. Like I had a salad. I made a salad at home. You know, had some questionable things in my refrigerator. And I was like, you know what? I can handle this. And like literally an hour later, my body was like, joke's on you. Mm-hmm. So I was really sick on Sunday night and it impacted my day on Monday of work, which was really hard because... I hate feeling like I'm incapable of doing the things I have to do on my to-do list.
Yeah.
So that was really frustrating. But thankfully, I have quite a few peaks. I'll make them brief. One of them was Shabbat, Alana being back. It's been so fun, so lovely, the dinners we've been going to together. And another one has been the yoga studio that I used to teach at, I has opened back up in person, which I'm telling you, I never saw the light of day. I never thought it was going to happen. And then got the email and all of a sudden they rehired me. And now I teach 3 times a week before and after work and things like that at Core Power. And I will say there's something about having a side passion other than what you do full time, such as this podcast, teaching yoga, etc. I know Liz has like her lifestyle brand and that's like, no, but it is something that you're...
Poosh, I'm the other Poosh. No, I'm totally...
Goop.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Like
agree.
It's something that gives you, you know, drive outside of what you do every day. And it's just like...
So important.
It's so important. And like at times it's stressful. And at times I'm like, oh my gosh, like I have to wake up and lead a class of people who like want to move their bodies and they're looking at me for some reason. And I have to somehow like move them through a flow for an hour. But there's an energy that it gives me and like a buzz where I leave class and I'm ready for my day and I'm feeling so energetic. And it's just been like really, really nice to be back. And it's also just reminding me that like knock on wood, but like things are slowly coming back to normal and it just feels really good. So I haven't really had like major peaks recently, but here we are.
Those are big peaks. And I've been going to some of Sarah's yoga classes and they are tremendous. Like I used to be the kind of person who was like, yoga isn't going to do anything for me, but it really has helped me physically and mentally. Like people say, first of all, as people know, I've been like using my Peloton a lot and it really like it takes a toll on your muscles, and being able to do like heated yoga has been really, really helful. And I never thought I would say that. Like a year and a half ago when Sarah like invited me to come to her classes, I was like, I don't think I can like do that. And now I love it. And it's also been so nice mentally to like see you in that element is like really special, but also just in general, like I remember once, I probably told this story once, me and my mom went to yoga and like she started crying and me and my mom both cry like over anything, but I remember being like, why did she cry? Like what? We were in an exercise class. And now like I get it, because it's wow. You give yourself permission to like, it's just really is self-care, as corny as it sounds. And especially when the instructor is like literally the whole time saying like, move through this, and it just is, it's such a nice environment to be in. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's plenty of good yoga teachers, but you're the best one.
Oh, that's so nice.
Thank in the you. Whole world.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So with that, today we had John Jackson on the podcast today. If you look him up on the internet, he goes by D.JohnJackson. John has so many things going on in his life. Mm-hmm. He talks all about it. First and foremost, he created a documentary called What About Me? And he basically pieced together these stories and the lives of all types of Black men in America from all different walks of life. Mm-hmm. And his goal in creating that, as he articulated, was to sort of show that Black men, Black boys are not monolithic, that like the way that we consume or see Black men in the media, especially me and Sarah as white people, or just as people who don't have those experiences, the things that were fed about Black men. Mm-hmm. And he articulates that far better than I could. But the point is, that's an amazing documentary that sort of brings together a lot of different people. And then he also talked to us about his book, which is called What About Me? Walking the Tightrope as a Black Man in America. And that is more about his life. And he says how much it applies to all types of different people. But just for context, documentary is more bringing together a lot of different people. And then his book is really about his own life, his experiences that he knows and hopes can provide insight to people who ever feel marginalized, whether you're Black man, Black boy, you're a member of the LGBTQ plus community, whether you're a woman who's faced marginalization. So for so many reasons, Sarah and I were reflecting that we're so grateful he came on our show. Mm-hmm. We think his words and his message will resonate with everybody, but we also want to continue our mission of amplifying voices that are different from us, because if we try to talk about mental health, we know that it affects everyone, and we can only speak to our experiences. So we're so mm-hmm. grateful for his time and insight.
Yeah, he really had so many insightful things to say. I mean, it's not only insightful to hear from someone different than yourself in general, but John specifically has, I mean, an abundance of teachings and experiences that are so difficult for him and in his life. But he even explains that he has used those difficult experiences to help others mm-hmm. and to educate others and bring people together. And we're so grateful that he came on our podcast to speak about this speak about his experiences, because first of all, it's not easy. I assume it's not easy to speak about these difficult situations, but yeah. At the same time, like, we're just really grateful. And I just hope that everyone I know you will all take something away from this. Yeah, it was just really, really great. And we are just humbled and honored that he came on our podcast. That's honestly the best way to say it. That's how I feel.
Definitely. And I would say in advance, I don't know that this is a trigger warning, but I guess a content warning. We do talk about difficult subjects, like how, like, he talks about his experience interacting with the mm-hmm. police. So if that is something that maybe triggers you, or you just want to take note of before you start listening, want to mm-hmm. inform people about that. Nonetheless, we encourage everyone who is able to listen, because you'll hear something that either resonates with you, or you'll learn something from a person that's different from you. Yeah. Either is great. So we hope you enjoy.
Enjoy.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How's your day going?
Good. Good. It's hard to believe it's 7 p.m. because it's like still so light here. I'm so used to it getting dark early.
Right, right. That is the great wonders of standard time, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Or daylight savings time. Maybe we're in daylight savings time, or maybe we're in standard time. But it's still light here. So that's pretty cool.
Where are you located?
I am right outside of Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, very nice. How did you end up there? Have you been there your whole life?
World headquarters. I'm an executive for Fortune 50 company. So it's where world headquarters is.
You know, that is actually a great place to start if you're ready to kick off.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and like your background and sort of why you wanted to talk about these things that you're talking about.
Sure. You know, I've had a very wonderful career, still participating in it, a tech background, engineering, science, artificial intelligence, and those kind of things. And over my career, you've always had this inkling or the desire to give back. And as I look at the corporate world, traveling the world, seeing places and things and people, that's just always been a part of me. And at this juncture in my life, I've decided that I want to do something that's closer to my purpose so that I can give back more. And I think that's where this whole thing comes together. It's a circular, you know, sphere of life. You've done good things. You've had very good success. You're still having success. But what can you do to reach back and help someone?
Makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really admirable. And I think a lot of people over the past year especially have felt compelled to sort of like regroup and figure out what really matters. Mm-hmm. So we would love to know like the timeline of how you decided to write your book and do the documentary you did. Like, when did that project start and why?
You know, actually the book started years ago. I've been keeping notes and manuscripts since I was about 10 years old.
Wow.
and taking bits and pieces, putting them in a notebook folder, and just maintaining those and writing little snippets down. But really, it got serious with the book about 12 years ago, 14 years ago, actually. My father passed away. And he and my mother's still here, kicking strong, but they poured so much into me, so much about respect, so much about treating people right and how to deal with the world. So I've just kept all of that with me. And so I've been writing bits and pieces here and there. And then when he passed away, I said, wow, I really need to think about how to document what they poured into me. And as my mother's getting up in age, I wanted her to have a opportunity to see it and see her words, her wisdom poured into me, played back into the world. So that's where the book starts. You know, in earnest, about 3 years, really writing different manuscripts. And, you know, the book that you've got now is probably maybe a third or 25% of everything that I'd written. But it was felt that let's do it in snippets so it's easily understandable and easily readable. And let's get those major things out there and come back with others later. When it comes to the documentary about 2 years ago, I'd always wanted to do more to give back. And I had a good friend, Taru Brooks. I was making a speech in Los Angeles and ran into this guy back in, gosh, it must have been February 2019. And we were talking and he was remarking about my tie and just a conversation. And then all of a sudden I realized, you know, he's a publicist in Hollywood. He does a lot of different things. And so we talked about different ideas and how I wanted to give back. I talked about the book and he was like, wow, documentary would be great. And we played it out and we talked more about it. And I said, let's do it. And I decided to do it. And so he and another one of our brothers, a good friend, Daryl Pitts, we came together and formed that union. And the documentary came to life. And in about 2 years, you know, it was serendipitous. These things weren't planned to launch in February of 2021. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I was preferring to have them sooner, but COVID hit. Mm-hmm. A lot of things happened. And it ended up being February 2021, and they converged in this universal cosmic sphere of things, and they happened together.
So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the content of the book as well as the documentary? Like if they were to find both, what would they see? What would they read, et cetera?
All right. I'll start with the documentary. The documentary really is an expose on the untold stories about Black men and boys. You know, there is pretty much a accepted framework in media, mass media. You know, Black men are typically great athletes. You know, they win the Heisman Trophy. They do really well. They're entertainers. Nothing wrong with those things. But then the third bucket is usually they're on the wrong side of the law. So those themes get perpetuated, you know, constantly around the world. We wanted to come back and say, listen, Black men are doctors, engineers, hedge fund. They run hedge funds. They're attorneys. They're fathers, grandfathers. They coach Little League. They do soccer with their kids. They have an artistic side. They like music. They're funny. So we're not monolithic. And so the documentary actually talks about, it gives an opportunity to hear from a lot of different guys, entertainers, folks who've been wrongly incarcerated, young guys that are for the future. You got one student that's headed to Cornell, one student that's in, you know, just all of those things. And we brought that together to let people see these folks aren't monolithic. They're monolithic in some of their common themes and experiences with the police, racism, and those things. But there's so much to them, many, many depths of dimensions and those kind of things. So that's the documentary. Mm-hmm. For me, the book was more about my life and my experiences, what I had learned, and how I handle some of those challenges. And the book was designed to really educate. Yeah, there's been some rough things in life, you know, the good, bad, ugly, and indifferent. How I've been treated in those particular circumstances. But can we educate? Can we encourage? And can we inspire? And that's what I wanted to do, inspire. And says, you know, I made it through, but let me give you some of the ins and outs so people could really understand what's it like in the day in the life of, and what does that mean? So although it's about me and it's wrapped around my stories, it actually resonates in a broader sense. And the book says African-American men and young boys, but it's really for people of color, women, LGBTQ, anyone who feels marginalized, misunderstood, underrepresented, left out, forgotten, misused. What I try to do is encourage and inspire. And that's where I start to show those pieces coming together.
And you know what I love? This is really just a comment and not really a question, but I love the way that even the way you're speaking about it, it's, you know, people think they know, they hear certain labels, LGBTQ, a Black man, they think they know with one label what this who this person is, mm-hmm. what they want. And even by right. using Black men and boys, you're reminding people that these people are humans that started as children and they have aspirations and dreams. It kind of, it's just like, even that alone to me just like really touched me a lot, because it reminds us that we're all more than just our label.
Yeah. And that's so true. As I write the book, and again, my family, my upbringing, you know, again, my mom and dad at 4 or 5 years old, you treat everybody with respect, regardless of their race, color, creed, religion, socioeconomic background. And not only did they teach it, you know, they showed us with these real life practical examples. They exposed us to different kinds of people, people in different situations, so that you could at least have some sense of understanding, or at least ask questions about those who are less fortunate, or if those are those folks that are different. You know, I talk about it a little bit in the book, some of the earliest experiences where my mother used these object lessons and examples, and it just works out this way, but it makes the teachings much more, I guess, apparent and much more real, because while you can say she's always said this, he's always said this, but they actually showed me, you know, what it's like. And it was always, regardless of where you came from, it was Mr. or Mrs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my dad would say, hey, look at our family. Look at this rainbow coalition of people, of all of these different mixtures. How could you not respect everyone? Mm-hmm. How could you dislike or treat someone differently when this rainbow coalition of what you come from is like this? And so those are the early teachings that have just really, they're a part of my fiber.
I think that that's a lot of people could benefit from being more like that, but also, of course, reading about situations like that. I think that that's unfortunately more rare than it should be. Obviously, Sarah and I talk about mental health, and we wanted to kind of pick your brain about, because you're talking about how the representation of Black men is kind of monolithic. And to me, I would also maybe use the word like two-dimensional, because when you see Black men portrayed in the media as one label, mm-hmm. as not a Black man, you think, well, like, you know, you can't make room for the idea in your head that these are also people who might have the same challenges we have as white women, like mental health mm-hmm. problems, mental health challenges, and especially given the specific traumas that are occurring and have been occurring within the Black community. I would love to know more about your experience with your mental health, however you want to speak mm-hmm. on it, and also how you think your mission aligns with trying to help the mental health of Black men, Black people, or marginalized people.
Yeah. I think the first thing is that there's always been a little bit of a stigma mm-hmm. in the Black community about mental health. I tell people, get help. Get help if you can. Seek help. There's no shame. There is no burden that you carry by asking for help, because some of these things are deeply, deeply rooted. When you think about African-American men and boys, this is for years, hundreds of years from slavery up until now. And then the microaggressions of today, when someone realizes that you are living in a world where things happen that you really can't speak back or say something about it because you may lose your job, or somebody mistreats you or ignores you, can't really say anything about it, just have to suck it up and take it in. My good friend, attorney Todd Belcour in Chicago, talks about these traumas that are cumulative. And when somebody treats you wrong or disrespects you at work or talks about you or denies you a promotional opportunity or excludes you, and you're like, but I did everything right, I'm trying to be the best I can, there is a cumulative aspect to that mm-hmm. where, for me personally, I think depending on the situation, that can start to manifest itself physically. Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, in my corporate and educational world, I've seen a lot of things, and there have been some cases where, you know, there was a period where it was really hard. You know, you ask yourself, why is this person treating me so harshly? But you realize that your blood pressure is going up. You realize that you don't sleep well. You realize that your mind is always in a frenzy. You're walking on eggshells. You know, there's a section in the book I talk about walking on eggshells. Mm-hmm. And that walking on eggshells is that you don't want to make a mistake. So can you imagine that heightened sense of tension, anxiety, and frustration that you're, everything you do or say, you know, if you say right, it should have been left. Or if you say up, it should have been down. Or it could be perfect if somebody else says it, but if you say it, it's wrong. And so you're trying to maintain. And I think a lot of people, wherever they are. They could be in entertainment, they could be in banking, they could be on Wall Street, they could be wherever. When people have control of your life or have control of your earnings and those kind of things, they can be, I'll just use the term, vindictive, and can put you in a position of, wow, if, and I'm not talking about the normal thing where you work, you have a boss and right. you do, yeah, yeah. you got to do the right thing. But I'm talking about those things that are vindictive, where they put you in a position where you don't know where you stand, or those microaggressions where you're told one thing and something else happens. Mm-hmm. So that's what I see about the mental anguish. And I think many people do that. And that's my experience. But then I think about, you know, all of us young men, black men are taught early. You know, when you're driving in your car, here's a whole series of things that you have to do. You know, unfortunately, we see what's playing out in the world today. But I can say this in a common thread. You know, mostly every black man and boy goes through this discussion about what not to do if pulled over. And that's not only if you're like the head of a corporation. You know, if I run out here now and put on a hoodie and I go jog in my community and it gets dark, I got to think twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got to really think twice. Or if I, you know, I got pulled over once and the guy said, is this your car? I mean, it was like the first question, is this your car? I mean, you know, where does that come from? So it's these type of pensive things that occur that you have to deal with. And I think that's where the mental aspect of it. And I think a lot, you know, a lot of things people don't realize. They feel like I'm frustrated, I'm angry, my home life is not good. But it's this cumulative aspect of all of these stressors that are in you. And let's just say it's been that way for years. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you know, again, I think that manifests itself physically, which is not a good thing.
I wonder how, because obviously when you talk about these systemic issues with the police, with bosses at your company and how like oppressive those scenarios can be, obviously there has to be a lot of change that happens systematically. Like I don't want to say like I'm placing any that black men have to do something differently, but I do want to know, what would you say to like an employee of yours or a person you're mentoring, like a black man who comes mm-hmm. up against these situations? Because as it slowly, hopefully starts to progress systematically, there are still going to be, we see it every day, these mm-hmm. situations that happen, whether it's at work, whether it's on the street. So what would you say to someone you're mentoring, a son, someone that you care about? Yeah. Like what would that conversation yeah. be for you?
Well, the first thing I mentioned is this, is that don't let your baggage block your blessings. That's a term that I took from my grandmother many years ago. And the reason I say that is you can get caught up in labeling a group of people and saying they're all bad. Mm-hmm. But when in actuality, there have been some great people in my life of all races, colors, and creeds and genders. Matter of fact, some of the most influential people who've been in my life have not been black. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the things. So I tell people to first and foremost, be objective, understand the lay of the land. That's very important to understand where you are. What are the norms? What are the different things that are going on? Obviously, you have to walk a tighter rope, a finer line. You can't become comfortable. And this is usually said a lot of times in the black community. You have to be 10 times better, or twice as good. You know, there's some truth to that. There's some truth to that. But you explain to people, you do your best job. Try to establish yourself in a manner that shows your value and your worth. And don't ever let anyone take away your value and your worth. And the other thing is to be true to yourself. You know, there are some circumstances maybe you have to walk away from. If someone is taking your dignity, that is really hard. And so, ladies, let me explain something to you about that. And it depends on the stage of life you're in. If you're a young man, you know, you're just graduated, you've got the world tiger by the tail. And you're having a good time. You go to this company and things like that. You can go to the next company. Go to this company and you're like, hey, I didn't like this. This worked out. So you have a lot more latitude. But let's just say you're 40 or 45. Let's just say you're somewhere in that age range. And you got three kids and a wife and a mortgage and two cars. And you're trying to save for college. The story becomes different then. And the angst and the anxiety increases exponentially. Because now it's no longer just you and your way of life. It's these dependents who are depending on you. And let's add, if you're taking care of a grandmother or a sick father or that extended family, that's when the stressors are extremely, extremely intense. And I think that's where people say, well, I got to stick it out. I got to survive. I was asked the other day, well, how do you get into these situations? How do people get here? And I said, well, first, it's a part of survival. You need your paycheck. Whether you're a taxi driver or whether you work as a security guard or whether you clean up a hotel or whether you're working on Wall Street, you know, you've got bills. You need your job. And if this is your mechanism to survive, you get to a point that you say, I succumb to it and I just have to survive. Mm-hmm. And then you have to survive. Then you're in a position of, oh my gosh, you know, it's been 5 years and I've been going through this. And I don't know, even that I survive, even if I've survived 5 years, I don't know if the next day is it. And that's whether you're in medical school, if you're in law school, wherever you are, you're fighting to get your, to get to your goal. And you're trying to survive and you're trying to thrive. But you're like, oh, is the next day a good day or a bad day? So those things are on top of the inherent stresses of just life. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to get educations, trying to pursue your dream. Those things are stressful. They're exciting. Reaching your ideal job, taking care and doing things, that's exciting. But if you add these other things on top of it, you know, the intensity of the stressors is just a remarkable to the point of some folks, they can't bear the load. And I think that's where you have to really reach out and get some help.
Mm-hmm. Of course, obviously, you've been very successful in your career. And, you know, I wonder, were some of these things that you're telling us now, are these things that you would say you learned throughout your experience? Or when you were young and you were just starting out, like, did your parents really, you know, kind of prepare you for these things? And I'm sure it was a mix of both. But what are some of the things that your parents told you as you were entering in the in your career, in your job? Were they, you know, kind of mentally preparing you for what might happen? Or
yeah, you know, my dad and my mom talked to me like an adult. I think I was 5 years old. And I always, especially my dad, he was very matter of fact, all the right edges. You know, my mom came back and smoothed the edges and gave me the facts and one of those kind of things. But they always instilled a sense of pride, a sense of hard work, work ethic, do your best. And then as you're running to get to your goal, always try to help somebody else. Never be too busy to help somebody, not only just less fortunate. Sometimes people need a hand. So as they were explaining that, then at that time, and this is very young, I'm talking 9 years old, 10 years old. I talk about it in the book. My mother says, listen, I just want you to know, regardless of what you do, there will be people who dislike you. I can see her now. There will be people who dislike you based on the color of your skin, based on how you talk, based on what you know, based on how smart you are. Because she said, there'll be people like, how dare you be that smart? And she would tell me these things. She says, you've got to be able to handle this because you're young now. But as you get older, you have to be aware. And so there was a preparatory place where they talked about it and laid the foundation. And since it's in my head and I knew about it, I'm like, okay, I got to realize this. But not until you experience it. That's when it all comes crashing back. And then the question is, how do you handle it? And so early in my career, in my university career, you know, I experienced things and I was like, wow, that's not good or that's not cool. But you experience it and you realize and you hearken back to, aha, that's what's going on. And as you go through school, postgraduate school, you do all these things and you just start to accumulate the experiences. And I will tell you this, you know, Liz and Sarah, sometimes when I was younger and even now sometimes, but yeah, definitely when I was younger, I says, why is this stuff happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Why are they treating this way? Or why is that happening? I'm a good guy, that kind of thing. So you would question yourself. And I think that's something when you start to question yourself, you got to pull yourself up. And then I realized as I got older, I said, it's because of those experiences I can share. I've learned and now I can teach others and help others so that they will be able to overcome, remain encouraged, that kind of thing.
I love that. I think one phrase that people always say that kind of bothers me is that everything happens for a reason. And I think that it's hard to like say that when you see these terrible things happening. But I think what you're reflecting on, what I'm hearing is like, you can look back and see in hindsight how you're able to now help people because of your experiences. And I wouldn't say, oh, well, that's why you went through that hard thing, because that's not right. But I think it's admirable that you're able to use some of these difficult experiences, and you've been elevated to a position of higher power, and now you're knowledgeable about the difficulties. So that was another question I had, was like, in, because you work in like the corporate landscape, and obviously, you know, we as white people have seen the catalyst for change over the past year because of the amplification of what had already been happening between Black people and the police that we might not have been as aware of. So we want to know, have you seen, are you hopeful about lasting change? I mean, you might only have one perspective from your job, but you, nonetheless, like, it's an important one. Have you seen things changing over the past year that you think will last? Have you seen things that you're kind of like, well, that was just kind of a grab for that month when everything was going on? Like, how do you see the landscape changing or staying the same?
Well, you know, I've seen a lot education-wise, company-wise, different companies and things the last 30 plus years. And I will tell you this, is that there are issues. Mm-hmm. There are issues, and those issues still exist because they're deeply rooted. It's just the way it is. But one of the things that's very encouraging is this, and I'll mention after George Floyd, I think the allyship that we saw and that we're now seeing is a positive. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look out and you look after George Floyd was murdered, you look at all the people of every race, creed, and color saying, you know, what's justice, what's right. I think that's very encouraging. That's a positive sign. And I think even as you look at different companies in the sports world, you look at the entertainment world, the corporate world, people trying to rectify and remedy wrongs of the past, I think that's good. But what you have to do is institutionalize the corrections so that 5 years from now, a new group comes in and it all goes back to the way it was. And I think that's what you have to do. You have to make that change in an institutionalized and systemic manner to affect the lives of people. Because again, we're all human. And you know, you can't just throw money at it. You just can't, you know, run a commercial. You've really got to believe it, and you've got to exhibit it. You know, whether you run the NBA, whether you run a major hedge fund, whether you run any type of business that uses the community, that sells to the community and looks to sell its goods. And I think that's the only way, honestly, that you can say this is change. So there are parts of me that I feel encouraged about. You know, obviously there are some things that you see that you're like, wow, we still have some very, very tough things to deal with and challenges because mindsets and things. And what I do too, you know, I speak on a lot of things and people are seeing the book. You know, I've been speaking since I was, oh gosh, 5 or 6 years old. And I used to speak on the Roman Empire as a little kid, six years old. And it's just a very interesting, this interest that popped. And what I, in one of my recent presentations last year, I talked about racism anywhere. History has proven racism anywhere does not bode well for a person, for groups, for families, for individuals, for cities, for states, for countries. And I said, you don't have to go far. I said, I can go back way back in history, but I can look at Nazi Germany. You know, I can look at Bosnia Herzegovina. I can look at Rwanda. You know, I can look at, you know, just a lot of different places. And when I look at these things and I've actually understood the workings of what led to it. And I said, wow, we really have to be careful, because when you look at the Serbs and the Muslims, you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, you look at in Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis, and you say, my gosh, how could this hatred boil over into such mass destruction? So those are examples that we don't have to look far. And if you want to go back a little farther, you go to slavery and you look at the harmful, you look at the damage that persists to this day with not only that evil framework, but the systemic racism that cascaded through every other part of life. And that's why a lot of people say, hey, you know, slavery ended, you know, a long time ago, it's hundreds of years ago. No, the systemic processes cascade all the way through, even to this day, because when you look at things from real estate to banking, you look at all these things and it's like, wow, this was well orchestrated. And so you just can't fix that overnight. So that's what I try to teach. That's where the education comes in. I try to give people that framework says, now let me put you in that position. Right. And let's see how you will respond. Anyway.
Yeah, no, we both fully agree. And I think that in history, we've seen instances where people believe that their kind and everyone looking or acting the same way will ensure their own success. But in the end, it's always proven every single time to be more harmful towards everyone. And one of my favorite quotes is, I just forgot the quote, but it's growth doesn't come from comfort zones. And I think people are just so comfortable in their own with people who look like them, sound like them, talk like them. And at the end of the day, you don't grow from that. The only way you can expand your mindset is by meeting people who are different from you and speaking with people who have different perspectives. I mean, we've been doing a ton. I know I'm very junior in the corporate landscape, but I work in an advertising agency. And, you know, a lot of what we're doing right now is we do a lot of diversity and inclusion, trainings. And it's really opened, I think, all of our eyes to just how much better our work can get by understanding different perspectives. I mean, if I'm selling, I work on P&G, Procter & Gamble. Like, if I'm selling P&G, there's no way that I can be successful if I only know what a white Jewish woman wants. Right. Like, there's just no way I'm not saying you learn and you grow so that you can do better at your job. I'm just saying, like, it really it impacts everything in life.
If you guys think about team, this is another example that I use. Pick your team, whatever sports you like. If you don't like sports, just figure out one. If you've got a team, you want everybody on that team to be the best that they can be so that you can win the big game, the big championship, or whatever. How would it play out for you to exclude, you know, a third of your team and say, hey, we're not letting those guys and ladies play because some wear blue shirts and some wear white blouses and we're not letting them play. And you get in the midst of this big game and then you realize, wow, we needed those guys because competitively they had some great ideas. Well, it's too late when you lose the game. And I use that example a lot. I says for people who like sports, whether it's hockey, cricket, you name it, whatever your sport is, swimming, think about making every person on your team be the best that they can be, which makes the team stronger. And so to your point, companies, organizations, entertainment, the entertainment area, banking, whatever it is. And then the other example that I use is the boat. I say, if we're sailing across the North Atlantic in this huge boat, it's cold and we've got one group of people on one side of the boat says, hey, I'm going to blow this boat up. I'm going to drill a hole in it because I don't like those people on the other end of the boat. And there's a few people in the middle saying, hey, wait a minute. Don't do that. Because if you blow up that end of the boat, guess what? It's going to blow up our end of the boat and we'll all sink. And there always will be people says, well, I don't care. I'd rather sink than be with those people. But most right-minded people would say, let's work together. So I try to use those analogies to help people understand, let's get beyond the complicated ideologies. Let's treat people as humans. Let's understand that we're better together. And, you know, I just think that's the way the world will be a better place to be for all of us, our kids and grandkids. You know, Dr. King said, you know, we'll either learn to live together as brothers, and I paraphrase it as brothers and sisters, or we perish as fools. You know, that's really true.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think one thing that we've learned so much about is how the idea of like the American experiment or the melting pot was, you know, it's a good idea in theory, but the way that it sort of exploited a lot of people in order to get like, you know, you have like an elite group of people making all of the roles. I think hopefully having these sorts of conversations with people that are different from us, who are different from you, we get there. Like we get to that place that we were always supposed to be in, which is, being a better people because of working together. And that's not the, as Sarah said, like, that's not the only thing. We should also know that we have to have empathy for other people just because they're other people, not because it makes us a better country or better company. But that's another way to look at it. Like, we are all better off when we have these conversations and know that just because we have these conversations doesn't mean everything's solved, because we still have different lived experiences. But how important it is to talk about these things is, that's not a question, but it's just a comment.
Yeah, I agree. I, And when I speak around the country on leadership and just a lot of different things, teamwork, even technology, when I'm talking about different things, I talk about STEM and technology and getting more people in and what does that mean? But I always ask this question. I say, why is it that in the movies in Hollywood, and I always think about the 4th of July, why does it take a catastrophic event, for everybody to come together and rally and say, oh, there's a big bad boogeyman or aliens or something out there? And I said, this is where I learned from Hollywood. I said, you know, why is it that everybody comes together then if there's some cataclysmic event? I said, if we were to think about that prior to that and leverage the goodness out of that in our daily lives and just the wholesome being of being a part of this magnificent world, wow, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess one of the things we ask a lot of people is, especially, you know, people in positions of power like yourself, how do you every day try to take care of yourself?
Oh, that was my next question.
Like,
as well.
You talk so much about holding all these stressors on your plate because there are people depending on you, not just you, but the hypothetical father, the hypothetical person, you know, with a lot of people counting on them. And obviously it's not easy, but what are some of the things that you do to try and manage?
Yeah, I think it's important. I did this algorithm some years ago. And just to the point that you're asking, there's a lot of pressure. I tell people, if you want to be a leader, formal or informal, you got to really think about that. Why do you think about that? Because there's so many other people depending on you. So I did this algorithm where I was looking at, you know, the number of people that reported to me. And then I looked at their families. And this is all theoretical. But you start to look at it, says, wow, there may be 15 to 18,000 people in this network of families, neighborhoods, grandparents, extended family, church, synagogue, mosque, communities, all of these people depend on your decision. Mm-hmm. So I tell people, never take it lightly when you're dealing with the lives of individuals. So I take that very personal in every way, and I try to make sure people are treated right. So what do I do? You know, you got to exercise. You know, one of the things I realized, you know, the Harvard Medical School talks about, you got to get out there and get the blood pumping. I think you've got to do it for several, you know, at least several times a week. I try to go every day, but try to get in about 45 minutes or an hour. That's first and foremost. You got to practice positive thinking. You got to pray. You know, for me, prayer is the huge, my faith is a major, major part of sustaining me. I think you have to have outlets. You got to find those trusted partners that you can talk to. And that's tough sometimes, but you got to find somebody that you can just let down and say, hey, I can't handle this. And it may not be some formal professional where you're in therapy, but you know, it may be a good friend, somebody that can talk you off the cliff and talk you through those things. So I think that's important. The next thing I think that you have to do, you really have to always survey who you are and remain true to yourself. You got to take a moment and pause and say, what's important in life? What's important in life and how, you know, what's my purpose? Why am I here? And not to get deep about it, just say, let me think about it. You know, I've been given this gift and I don't know how long I'll be here. So let me take full advantage of it. So I think those are the kind of things I do, staying positive, trying to help people, exercising, keeping your mind going. I tell people to read and talk to people. Talk to people. I remember there was an author, Studs Terkel, some years ago, who went around the country and did this book on talking about all these different people. In Zoom, it's actually easier. You can talk to people all over the world and do different things. Get some fresh ideas. Keep your mind percolating. So I've had a chance to do that. And so I would tell people, you know, whatever you can do, stay young in mind and heart and spirit, and get help if you need it, but definitely clear your mind. I've told my team this. If you can find 15 minutes, it may not be every day, but every other day, find you 15 minutes where there's just solitude and serenity and just clear your head. And, you know, in this COVID world, take a walk, maybe at night, take a walk, just little things.
Yeah, for sure. And I know we're kind of on a positive note right now, but I do want to ask, you know, in regards to everything that has happened over the last year, how have you taken your taken care of yourself in that sense? I mean, do you find yourself having to turn off the news some nights or step away from all of the things going on. I mean, I think for all of us, it's hard to watch, but especially as a Black man, when you're seeing things happen in your own community, I can imagine that it's not easy to see it and hear it all the time.
Yeah, it does get to a point. You're like, I just got to take a break. Go find something that's mindless to free your mind, because it's there. You, when you see some of the horrific things that occur, because what's always harboring really close in the back of your mind is, that could be me. And I think, for whatever you say, I've got a friend who's a physician in the Virginia, Maryland area. And he always talks about, he's an ER surgeon. He says, I wear my scrubs and my ID badge on me all the time, going and coming. Depending on what's happening, he's trying to go to work or whatever. He says, that way I can clearly identify myself as a doctor and prove that I am a doctor, and that, you know. So, I mean, when you think about it, individuals always have to take split seconds to think about what they say or do. Now, granted, there'll be some folks who say, hey, I never thought about that. Everything's cool. Life is good. Well, I would just tell them to get out more and understand the bigger world.
Yeah, sure. I think that that's really important too. I feel like people, I mean, especially I feel like people our age, because we grew up in the really in the digital age, we all feel either obligated to constantly pay attention to social media, or we're just like addicted to it, whether we like it or not. So it's refreshing to hear that someone, especially someone who is definitely busy, and as you said, has people depending on you, that you're able to kind of say like, that's not serving me right now. And this is, and like, not to mention, it's a part of your daily existence. Like, forget just seeing it on TV. You're like, I live this. Right. I know this feeling. Right. So I think that that's, you know, both a message that's good for people like you to hear, but also for everyone, like, that there's hope. You don't have to be watching this all the time in order to be a good, informed person.
No, you don't. And just, you know, absorb the information, absorb the facts, but it does get to be exhausting. I remember that I was on a panel right after George Floyd, and somebody asked me, what does it feel like? I said, it's exhausting when you have to every day, again, back to the tightrope. And I talk about walking on eggshells. If you could just look at that metaphor, or metaphorically think about a tightrope and on eggshells, and then trying to balance yourself in every move, that kind of makes it very, you know, real in terms of that. But then the other part of it I look at is that as I talk about the tightrope, as I talk about those different pieces, I also try to make it clear that my mind's eye of what I see and what I experience, you know, it's a processing. You know, you process things immediately and then you process it later and you go back and think about it. You know, I was on a podcast maybe, I don't know, 2 months ago, and the host asked me about being pulled over. And I said, yeah, I got pulled over about a year ago in my own neighborhood. Different from the time when the guy asked me about, hey, is that your car? This was going to work out, and I saw the silhouette. And I saw the silhouette, and I was like, oh. I says, let me get somewhere. And then sure enough, the blue lights come on. And this is where you use your best Bryant Gumbel voice. You know, you got to be as prim and proper as you can be. And yes, officer. I said, yeah, we heard that there were some break-ins. We got a call. There was some break-in in cars in this neighborhood. And I said, yeah, I live in this neighborhood. And I gave him, I live at this address, da 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 da. And I said, well, hey, I'm a concerned citizen. What was the description? And I look like I look now, but, you know, just workout gear. And he says, yeah, it was a Black male with dreadlocks, a lot of dreadlocks. Well, I said, you saw me coming to you when I passed you. So did I take my dreadlock wig off and throw it in the back seat? I mean, those are the kind of things. And he says, now have a nice evening, sir. Have a nice evening. Because when he saw me, he was like, oh, this is not the right dude. But the point was, you still go through that. You know, you grip the steering wheel. You know, it's a sphincter tightening kind of thing. You're like, you pull out all your wallet and get everything laid out. And you go through the deal. If anybody reads the book, you'll see how I talk about what we were taught and how most people are taught. And then, you know, and it's different from, I had a person one time says, oh, everybody gets nervous when the police pull you over. Said, there's a whole nother realm. There's a total different deal. People get nervous because they get pulled over. It's embarrassing, you know, and everybody's looking at you. I get that. You're nervous, but you're not nervous to the point of, wow, this could end fatally.
I mean, if I think I've been pulled over once, and I was nervous about getting a ticket because of what my parents would say.
Yeah.
And that's privilege. Like, I mean, it is. It's just, I mean, we can empathize, but it's even hard. My heart's pounding right now listening to you, and I'm not even in this situation. Yeah. So it's just, I mean, I just don't even have the words because it's really frustrating. And I think that I don't even know a fifth of the frustration. So, you know.
Yeah. So thank you for talking about it with us, because in as much as like we don't understand it because we don't experience it, it's always better to hear. Like,
right. And right. And we both know that it's as you said, it's exhausting. And so we do really appreciate you sharing these experiences with us, because although it may not be, you know, the most lighthearted conversation, especially for you, but you're expanding our minds and as well as our listeners. And that's hopefully what it's not your job, but you're doing it. And we just appreciate it a lot, because hopefully this is what's going to change the hearts and the minds of people, is by continuing these conversations and just listening.
Yeah, it's, I think dialogue, as I talk about it, dialogue and experiencing and acknowledging, I think that's such a great way to connect and to get that common ground. And just the experiences, when I talk about in the book, and when I'm on the road or prior to COVID, you know, you're in a suit, you're dressed and whatever. And even that, you get these microaggressions, or either you get these stares, or either, you know, everybody talks about the elevator. And, you know, it's just like, wow, what is that? I will tell you something I hadn't told any other podcasters, and it's not even in the book. I was some years ago at another company, and I work for a great company now, but I was in a suit and I made a presentation, and this gentleman walked up to me and he said, well, you know, I was wondering if there was anything to you and if there was anything behind that suit. And he just walked up just as matter-of-factly and just, you know, it wasn't a joke.
Everybody was complimenting
you. It wasn't complimenting me. It was like, and I think I'd made a comment. So it was like my comment had validated that maybe I had the right to be there a little bit, but it was just the matter of fact way of, well, I was wondering if there was anything to you other than that suit. I remember just like it was yesterday. So, I mean, those are the things that you go through. And then what do? You can't pop off. You just smile and say, hey, will you be, you know, you'd be surprised what you'd find in a suit, you know, and you just kind of blow it off and keep going. You come back with a quick quip and you move on. But later on, you think about it. He's like, wow, you know, I've done this. I've done that. I've done this. I've done that. What gives you the right to say that to me? It's life, though.
Where did you grow up, by the way? I don't think we got that. And I'd love to know if that's okay.
Yeah, did a lot as a child, but I consider Memphis my home. I consider Memphis my home. My grandparents are here, so.
Very nice.
Consider Memphis my home. Awesome. But again, got a chance to see a lot and do a lot.
That's great. Do you have any other general? No. Okay. We want to give you the chance to plug your book, your documentary, anything else you want to share with our listeners before we sign off.
Oh, sure. My book, What About Me? Walking the Tightrope as a Black Man in America, is available on Amazon. It's bestseller status, so it's out there. So everybody pick up a copy. It's really about educating, using my life story and different interesting pieces about it. And how can we educate, encourage, and inspire Black men and boys, people of color, women, LGBTQ, men, anybody who feels like they're on a tightrope. It's been a tough haul. But definitely to educate the people about the experiences that I have had that are common to others, so that people will learn and have that empathy that you talk about. The documentary is on Amazon Prime Video. It's What About Me? It's out there now. You can check it out. It's a 46-minute documentary. It's got a lot of great reviews. A lot of people have asked about it. So that's been really a good thing. I will say this as we wind up. The calls that I have received from people of all races, colors, and creeds, from Canada, from Europe, from London, people talking about this, if I don't accomplish anything else, starting the conversation via the book, via the documentary, via these podcasts, I think that's a huge step. You can reach me at d.john_Jackson on Instagram. On Facebook, it's at D. John Jackson. On LinkedIn, it's at D. John Jackson. my book, if you want to see more about the book, you can go to my website, which is www.djohnjackson.com. And if you want to go to my company, 5J Entertainment, and you can see a snippet of the actually the trailer and some other things about me, that's at www.5j-entertainment.com. So a lot of different ways to link up with me. My goal and my purpose is to help all of us be better. To whom much is given, much is required. And I just want to make this a better world for all of us, regardless of your age, race, creed, or color, and whatever I can do. Hopefully my little piece helps.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Thank you so much. This has been so valuable, even just to us, but we know it'll be valuable for the people who listen to. We so appreciate your time and your insight.
Yeah.
Well, great. It's my pleasure to be on the show with you. Thank you for having me. And I am proud of what you're doing because I see the spark and the fire.
Thank you.
I see it. And you know, for you guys to do that. So,
that means a lot. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that energy, that kinetic energy that I always talk about. So I see it.
You just made my week.
Thank you so much.
This was really, really special. So thank you again. And I hope you have a great night.
Thanks a lot. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
So that was our episode with John. As you heard, he's amazing.
Amazing. So insightful and
so kind.
Wise, comforting. That was the word I was going to use.
Respectful. Yeah. I mean, he spoke a lot about respect and how that was a value that he learned at a young age. And I think that, you know, I don't think many people, for some reason, I think we're taught that from school maybe, but I don't think parents grill respect as much as they should. Maybe I'm generalizing, but.
No, I think.
You just don't hear it as much as he, like his parents really taught him how to respect others.
I agree. And I think it's just critical. It gets lost a lot. I think because of the tough year that everyone has had, there's like this diminishing of respect. And I understand like it hasn't been easy, but I think let's get back to that, people.
Yeah.
So we're
especially
grateful.
Online.
Oh, I mean.
People are so mean online.
I know. We're so glad that you listened to this episode. Mm-hmm. You can follow me on social media at Liz Height. Well, you can follow me on Instagram at Liz Height. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at It's Fine, I'm Fine PD, Instagram, TikTok at It's Fine, I'm Fine Pod. Where can people find you, Sarah?
You can find me at home most days. Just kidding. You can find me at Sarah L. Sassone, that's N like Nancy, on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. I don't really post TikToks that often anymore, but if you want to add me as a friend and send me funny content, I will check it once a week.
I guess I also have TikTok, so that's Liz Height if you want to follow me there.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. I was cracking up at the TikToks you posted this week. The Let It Soak one.
Oh, yeah. That got like a fair amount of views. I was proud of that.
Yeah, I saw.
Someone commented like legend has it. It's still soaking. And I love those comments. They're so funny.
It was great.
Thank you.
That's it. With that, it's fine. I'm fine.
It's fine. I'm fine.
Bye.